From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Janet Napolitano, the president of the University of California, examines how colleges are supporting the needs of a changing student population as part of a special series on higher education. And singer Norah Jones talks about her latest album. It's called Daybreaks. But first, the days leading up to the second debate were filled with controversy. Mr. Trump found himself on the defensive after a video showing him making sexually aggressive comments about women in 2005. This as WikiLeaks posted emails that included excerpts of speeches made by Mrs. Clinton in which she expressed, among other things, a desire for free international trade. Andrew Sullivan is a political commentator and contributing editor to New York Magazine. Andrew, thanks for coming on the program.
Great to be here. Thank you, Tavis.
Let me start by asking, can Donald Trump still win this race?
Yes. I certainly don't want to rule it out. What he's writing is something very powerful, and I think people have underestimated it. It's a real movement. It's a movement that is pinned by what I have to call crypto-fascist elements. And these movements are very potent in the world right now and have been very potent in the past, and you underestimate them at your peril. When you actually put on the ballot the possibility of rounding up a whole bunch of people in your country that you may not feel great about and actually deporting them en masse, when you actually declare that you regard a whole religion as antithetical to the security of the United States and of the West, and you put that on the ballot, you will bring people out, you will evoke emotions, you will summon up passions that are very hard to contain and that seem to surge regardless of the individual characteristics of the person. And the other thing you have with Trump is an intensely gifted demagogue. Do not underestimate his ability to communicate to people. He's much better at it than Hillary Clinton is. He speaks in monosyllables, he sticks to very clear themes, and he has emotional power in a way that, sadly, she does not. So I am not in any way complacent about this election, and I think that Trump is riding a wave that has crashed in England, in Colombia, polls and election results, referendum results that have gone against everything everybody thought was going to happen and that have done real self-harm to both Britain and Colombia in the last few months. So we should not be complacent.
Clearly, I am not a Donald Trump supporter. I think my audience knows that by now. Certainly those who have followed my work over the last 30 years know that I am not a Trump supporter. Having said that, my friends keep laughing at Donald Trump and think he's an idiot and think he's ridiculous and think he's a fool. To my mind, Donald Trump performed better than he did in the first debate, particularly given what he was up against when that debate started, courtesy of the videotape. I thought he was much better debate number two than he was in debate number one. Not a supporter, but I'm talking about his performance. Do you agree or disagree with me?
No, I agree with you, Tavis. Specifically the last hour where he really marshaled two important arguments that he has. And they're two very simple ones. It's change. He definitely represents a change. I think it would be a disastrous and catastrophic one, but he represents that change in a country that wants change right now. And secondly, he's an outsider. And people want that outsider. They're infused by the idea of somebody completely new to the system coming in and blowing it up or seeing what happens. And Hillary Clinton is whatever else she is. She's not really about change. And she sure is an insider. She's a very weak candidate in this particular context at this particular time. And once he got past the first stuff, then he was able to get on the offensive on questions like Obamacare or foreign policy. And Clinton was just not aggressive or passionate enough in defending the record of the last 8 years. And after a while, let his absurd lies about the world sail over her, referring people to her website or fact checkers. Whereas, in fact, you have to take on full bore. For example, the notion that Obamacare has led to skyrocketing premiums unlike anything before, when, of course, premiums were going up crazily and healthcare costs were going crazily up before Obamacare. So there were certain things like that. I'd also say, at the same time, I mean, I don't know about you, but watching it, this man has so broken every conceivable civilized barrier in debate. I mean, by bringing the entire 1990s back in this desperate, really vicious way, when all he needed to do was apologize and be contrite. When he can't do it even then, you realize just how dangerous and reckless this man is. I mean, he saved himself to some extent, but he's also been engaged in amazing self-sabotage. And my worry is that if he were president of the United States, he wouldn't just be sabotaging himself. Mm-hmm. He'd be sabotaging all of us. And that should send a shiver up the spine of everybody in this country.
And yet it's a very minor thing, I admit, and I'll move off of it very quickly, but I want to get your thought. It's very minor, again, admittedly. But I thought that very last question, he was 100 times better than Secretary Clinton was when they asked a personal question, the only personal question of the evening, and the best she could do was talk about his kids. I thought that was his best answer of the night when it comes to that category of getting inside of who he is and the respect that he does have for the fighter in her.
Yeah, and he was able to show himself just for a minute in some kind of appealing way.
Yeah.
It just shows you that if he weren't sabotaging himself, he'd be a very lethal candidate. And it also shows you that she is actually one of the weakest Democratic nominees in many, many years. And we forgot that. We forgot Obama represented something passionate and new and positive. Clinton seems to be unable to connect with people. And I think that's incredibly hard for a president. I mean, a president has got to be able to communicate and connect. And she hasn't and she can't. Yeah.
She did not smash him on the videotape. I thought she was very measured in the way that she handles it. It was clear to me that her campaign advisors had suggested to her, this story is what it is. You're not going to gain anything by piling on because the American people have already made up their minds what they think about him vis-a-vis the videotape. Was that the right strategy for her not to crush him, not to pounce on the videotape?
I think it was actually the right strategy, however frustrating it was, because I think the story tells itself, and I think it's indefensible. Even he can't defend it. The fact that he couldn't immediately apologize for it, he couldn't take control of that issue, he had to turn it into another attack, was eloquent enough about how damaging and how awful a person he seems to be. And the moderators did a good job in impressing him on the key question there, which is not, did he use vulgar language? Now, everybody accepts that vulgar language in private is not disqualifying. What he was doing was bragging about assaulting women, sexually assaulting them. And that is a whole different category. Mm-hmm. It's not locker room talk. It is confession to a crime.
Yeah. His press conference, just moments, frankly, before the debate started, was that Bush League or was that brilliant strategy? Because Donald Trump was on every network for an hour and a half or so before the debate. Was it Bush League or was it brilliant strategy to do that press conference?
Look, I think part of what he does is throw so many outrages at you, say so many awful things, promise to do so many foul things in office, that you become disoriented. Uh-huh. And you don't quite know how to respond because it's one thing after another. I mean, one thing he's just completely making stuff up about Syria. It's another time where he was telling her that he was going to jail her were he to become president, which again is an attack upon our very basic constitutional system and an attack upon our liberal democracy. And yet you can't summon up the outrage at any single one of these things because he's already readying the next. This is a kind of attack mode that is suited mm-hmm. to our digitally addicted, instant gratification, Twitter-friendly culture. And he's mastered this era of mass distraction by constantly distracting us with more and more outrages and with more and more rhetoric and more just unbelievably foul acts in his own life. And I think that keeps you all bewildered all the time. And it's important for him to keep that up. I don't know how he does it,
yeah,
but that's how he keeps everybody off their equilibrium.
Let me play devil's advocate. And I'm only doing this because I really want to push you to get your take on this. So that you basically have rendered somewhat laughable this notion that if he were president, he would jail Hillary Clinton. I saw that moment a little bit differently. I don't think he handled it right. I certainly wouldn't have gone there the way he went there. But I, quite frankly, am sick and tired of the new president letting the old president off the hook when we know they broke the law. Gerald Ford did it with Richard Nixon. Barack Obama said nothing about George W. Bush and those war crimes that he committed. Many of us believe those were war crimes. And so these presidents, it's a boys' club, and I'm not naive, I get that. But no administration, no new administration wants to go after the old administration, no matter what crimes they may have committed. And I saw that moment as something different in my lifetime. I've never seen a debate where a candidate for president said to the other person, if I'm elected, I'm coming after you because you broke the law. You need to stand trial. Now, again, the way he went about it is, I think, was Bush League. But the very notion that finally someone in a presidential debate wants to hold someone accountable who was in office struck me in a way that I've never felt or seen that in my entire life.
Well, yes, except, of course, he was prejudging the course of justice.
He was
violating a core part of our Constitution, which is the Attorney General. On nonpartisan, certainly not directed by the president, does not prosecute anybody. He was ignoring the fact that this person has already been subjected to an investigation by the FBI, by a Republican attorney general, one should point out, and been exonerated. So to then say that I intend to overrule what the current investigation has said and make you go to jail was an attack upon our system of justice in this country. And it's one reason why people are legitimately afraid of him. I mean, I was interested, there was a New York Times story about business leaders who are not in favor of Trump, and none would go on the record. When asked why, they said they fear personal retribution. We know that he's already threatened the Washington Post with launching an antitrust investigation against Jeff Bezos and Amazon in their ownership of the Washington Post as retribution for their coverage of him in this campaign. This is a new zone. We live in a nation of laws. We do not live in a nation where one tyrant actually manages to do what used to be called bills of attainder, attacking individuals, prosecuting individuals, seeking revenge against individuals. So however, Tavis, one of the things I agree with you on with this is that one of the things that's fueling Trump is the fact that the elites in this country have been, absolutely free of accountability, have never been held to account or responsible for massive failures and or crimes. The failure of the 2008 crash, who on Wall Street was really held responsible for that? In fact, they're doing better than ever.
Yep.
The Iraq War, a catastrophe that no one fully took responsibility for, in which Hillary Clinton is still running for office having supported it. As you say quite rightly, a whole different category about mishandling emails, actual war crimes, the most serious crimes anybody could commit, just brushed under the rug by the Obama administration. So I totally think accountability is what's fueling his rise. And I think people behind him are right to call these elites unaccountable and want to hold them to account. Yeah. But the way he's doing it would destroy our entire system altogether.
We agree. Since we're talking about accountability, something else that's been on my mind, it is laughable to me, and I do mean, I literally sit back and kick up my legs laughing at how the media now is nearly universally condemning, the mainstream media now condemning Mr. Trump. I told some folk the other day, somebody said to me, the media builds you up and they tear you down. I said, well, that's right, but not really. Your conjunction is wrong. The media doesn't build you up and tear you down. The media builds you up to tear you down. They make money coming and going. They make money both ways. It's a game. So my question is, how complicit has the media been, the mainstream media, in helping to make Donald Trump? And now that complicity has turned to condemnation. I'm bothered by that.
I'm bothered too, Tavis. Look, when a leading network chief, Leslie Moonves, could say, Donald Trump's been really great for business. He may be awful for the country, but great for business, great for CBS. There you have an example of an elite, a member of elite, utterly trashing his own country, utterly abdicating any civic responsibility. No one who cared about the news and who cared about our democracy would have given Donald Trump's neo-fascist rallies complete 24/7 airing on major networks, would interrupt actual news events to give us those spectacles, because they knew simply that ratings is the only criterion they care about. I mean, at some point, our republic is in deep disrepair because these people are not acting as citizens before they're acting as profit makers. You know, when you go back to Plato's account of how tyrants emerge out of democracies, the one thing he said is that is also essential to that is that the elites become more interested in making money than in the fate and the character of their republic.
Yes.
And into that breach, a wannabe tyrant will arrive and can destroy democracies overnight. I mean, Plato didn't believe tyrants came out of aristocracies. He thought they came out of a chaotic democratic system in which virtue had disappeared. And I'd also say this, you know, reality television, we live with it, it's ubiquitous, it became essentially part. Donald Trump would be unimaginable without that as a rubric behind him. What we saw was a classic conflict-driven season finale of a reality television show. And he has helped bring us down to that level, and the media has been utterly complicit in fomenting it for only one purpose, and that is money. And it is disgusting, and some of us have to start speaking up against it.
Yeah. So speaking of the media, our friends in the media, everyone after every one of these debates spends an inordinate amount of time talking about the optics, which again, I find funny because I can't understand how it is that we spend so much time talking about the optics when his antics haven't pushed him out of his race. Do we really think the optics are going to trump the antics that he's engaged in?
No, I don't. I mean, optics, I mean, look at him. As he looks ridiculous. If you met that person at a dinner party or in the street or in a coffee shop, you'd be like, I don't know who that person is. He looks so weird. What's he got this strange tan on, this ridiculous hair, and this absurd manner? And why is he molesting all the women around him? And why is he making fun of a person with disability? He's an absurd character. But we have to remember, when you go back to the 30s and you look at similar characters from the past, Mussolini looks absurd. Hitler looks absurd. At the time, people thought they were buffoons, thought they looked stupid, thought their uniforms and their grimaces and their optics were all absurd. But the optics don't matter when you're riding this kind of anger and you're tapping into these kind of resentments. And that's what we learn at our peril.
So what does it say then, Andrew Sullivan, about a good slice of the Demos that he is the guy that they're with? What does it say then either about the deep-seated hatred or the pain that's too much to grapple with that so many fellow citizens are feeling that Donald Trump becomes their choice? What's it say about us?
It says that we're in a terrible state. I think that whatever happens this election, we have to look very carefully in the mirror at ourselves to see what's going wrong. Now, some of it, I think, is completely understandable. We're living in an age where technology is revolutionizing all of our lives and destroying countless jobs. The creative destruction that's been going on in this country and around the world the last few years seems to be accelerating. And people are rightly bewildered by this. It's also important, I think, to recognize that the social changes we've experienced, I mean, the racial demographics of this country, which you see in the demographics behind the election, the increasing power of black and brown voters, of racial minorities of all types, that has also been a bewildering shift, especially for people in their 60s and 70s who are Trump's core base of support. And when they don't feel they're living in the same country that they grew up in, they're reacting in emotional ways, and they're seeking things to blame, and they are seeking elites to attack. Then there's also the deep partisanship in this country. You know, it feels to me this election a bit like a really bad marriage, where one spouse is now doing things they don't really want to do, supporting something they don't really want to support, but they're doing it to spite the other person. And it seems to me that since the mid-90s, intensified by the 2000 election, intensified by the Iraq War, we've had this incredibly polarized country in which even someone like Trump, even someone manifestly unfit, will get to a 40% threshold just because he's not the other side. And then Hillary Clinton specifically is the most partisan emblem of all this. And she evokes loathing that very few other politicians on the Democratic side evoke among particularly the Republican base. So that's what propels this forward, disorientation and partisanship. And also, of course, economic stress. It's not as stressful as we might think it is. As certainly, we're not in a crisis like the 1930s, but it is destabilizing. And I think trying to understand that, I've been reading Arlie Hochschild's new book, which is called Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning in Louisiana, where she's trying to understand and talk to people. And people go into these rallies, you know. I have fellow reporters. Some of them have had horrible times. Other people have told me the people there are really great. They're welcoming. They're sweet. They want to be understood. And I think defanging and de-escalating that polarization should be number one task after this election.
Yep. It took us two debates to get to one question about the Supreme Court. What say you about why Hillary isn't using that more as a tool, or why it hasn't come up in the debates more often, why it's not being talked about more on the campaign trail? Here's an issue where there's a vacancy right now, and clearly this issue impacts all of us for 30 plus years to come. And to my mind, at least, it hasn't gotten the kind of traction or attention I think it ought to get. You feel similarly or differently?
I feel differently a little bit, because I think when you enter the right-wing media sphere and when you listen to the Republicans who really know better but are still supporting Trump, the court is the critical issue that's still doing it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think that the fact that we're at this pivotal moment with the Supreme Court, with several rather elderly justices and one actual open vacancy, has concentrated the minds of the religious right particularly. And one of the staggering things, to me at least, and one of the things that has completely unmasked certain elements of the religious right, is their support for this person who is clearly not just not Christian, but clearly in his attitudes and his mind and his actions, anti-Christian.
Mm-hmm.
They can still support him, and they're still supporting him, even after he's admitted to sexually assaulting women because of the court. So I think the court really is playing a role in this election, but it's playing it primarily on the right. And look at it this way, and this is what I would always say. If Trump wins, he's almost certainly likely to get the House, Senate, and the court. He runs the whole table. If Hillary wins, well, who knows at this point what's going to end up the result being, but it's likely the House will remain Republican. In one case, you have one person getting total control in the government.
Right.
The other, you have some shared powers. I know I prefer, as a small C conservative, to have those powers shared.
Right.
But I do think the court is a crucial question, obviously.
Yeah.
That's why the Republicans held this vacancy open.
And that's precisely my point. You've made my case better than I could. I think it ought to be discussed more. I think if I were advising Mrs. Clinton, I would tell her to talk about it more, because I think you're right. These Republicans, these conservatives are holding their nose, and they will vote for Donald Trump if for no other reason, because they know what happens to the U.S. Supreme Court that interprets the law for the next 30 plus years. That is the one reason you hold your nose and vote for Donald Trump if you're conservative. My point again is, I think it ought to be talked about more if I were her, but I digress. Andrew Sullivan, I am always honored to have you on. I'm always moved by your insightful take on these issues, and I'm delighted that you took the time to do it. Thank you, sir.
You bet, Tavis. Lovely to be here.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Over the next few weeks, I'll examine some of the most pressing issues in higher education today with experts in the field. Today, we'll look at the ways colleges are meeting the needs of a changing student population. Many of us see a typical college student as someone with little to no work experience or financial responsibilities. But the opposite is in fact true. Many college students are over the age of 24, bilingual, and do have jobs. Janet Napolitano is the president of the University of California. She shares how colleges are helping their students juggle their real world and academic responsibilities. She was, of course, the Secretary of Homeland Security under President Barack Obama. Welcome, Madam President.
Thank you.
What do you think that that your candidate, Secretary Clinton, has to do over the course of these debates to convince the American people that she ought to be their choice?
You know, I think what she needs to do is explain how is she going to work for people and address their concerns and put her energies to that over the next years of her presidency? What motivates her, why she cares so much, and what she's going to do?
What does she need to do to convince those young voters and pull in that Obama coalition that was so successful for him?
I think younger voters are thinking about their futures and what is the country going to be like? What is the world going to be like as they matriculate, as they graduate? What can they look forward to, and how is she going to help them get there?
Yeah. Have you been pleased over the course of this campaign with the level of conversation, the importance, the impetus, or lack thereof placed on affordable education?
It's been okay. Mm-hmm. It turns out that higher education rarely makes it into the presidential cycle for whatever reason, although it's so very important for our country. Actually, this campaign of 2016, we've heard more about it than we have had in campaigns past, and I think that has to do with primarily the economy and finances.
Yep. But she has, though, Secretary Clinton, has promised tuition-free. Is it junior college or two-year college?
Any public school, up to $125,000 of family income. Now, at the University of California, exactly. We already do that for students with families up to $85,000. So, unanswered yet is, then who pays for that quality of education? And what do you do with states that have already been supporting students to the degree California has versus states that haven't done anything? Do they get more support rather than less? That doesn't seem fair either. So those are the kinds of things you think about in terms of implementation. At this level of a campaign, at this late date, I think the goal is to set forth, this is the vision, this is where we're headed, this is why I need your help. And she needs to ask for that help.
Yep. Since we have seen some talk and heard some talk about education on the campaign trail, I led with this introduction a moment ago, letting people who might not understand that the demographic of what students look like today is so fundamentally different. I want to talk in a moment about how we serve the needs of that demographic, but tell me more about how students don't look perhaps the way we think they look or used to look.
This is the most diverse class in UC history. It has the highest number of transfer students in UC history. 42% of our undergraduates are the first in their families to go to college. It's a very different, perhaps, demographic picture of the University of California than 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. There's a proposition, it's been so many years now, was it 187 or 209 that made it even more difficult to get funding here in California for students of color? The Ward Connolly.
209.
They were both deadly to me, but anyway. So when Prop 209 passed, there was a great deal of concern in this state, before you arrived at UC. There's a great deal of concern in this state that when Prop 209 passed, it was going to make it difficult for us to see the kind of diversity that we needed to see on college campuses in this state. To hear you now say that this class is the most diverse is actually heartening to me.
Yes, but it's taken a lot of work and a lot of years to get there. It's been decades since 209 passed, and particularly with respect to African American students. This year is the first year in a long time where we've seen a substantial, measurable increase. Part of that is attributable to lots of extra effort we put into outreach with the African American community about the University of California and the great opportunity that this university presents for a young person. But we're going to have to continue to do that. 209 certainly doesn't help where diversity is concerned.
Yeah. So how do we serve the needs of this new prototype of a student at UC?
Well, in terms of age, they're perhaps not that different, with more transfer students a bit older. But these students are very competitive academically. They have to be to get admission to the University of California. They're very interested in kind of global challenges, and so helping them find their passion in that regard. We have things on carbon neutrality and food by way of two examples. Then it's making sure that because we are a research university, all of our students get exposure to the research process, what that means, and what kinds of doors that opens to their futures.
Yeah. What does it say about the state of our economy, and how do we address it when there are students who are a little bit up in age than what we typically think of, in part because the economy has turned so sour for so many of them that going back to school for them and getting more education is the best option. As a society, how do we start to address that influx of students trying to get back into the classroom?
Well, you need to think about older students, mm-hmm. and what they bring. Many of them have started families. We see this particularly with particular populations like returning veterans. So mm-hmm. we have an increased population of those who have been serving in our military. They're older, they've already had that experience. There's a maturity that goes along with that, and they want to get done. They're ready to get on with their lives. And so making sure that credits transfer, that they're not having to repeat coursework that perhaps they took in community college, then get on with their major and get on with their lives.
Yep. Across the board, I know UC has an example already in place. What say you about the lack of affordability of college these days for so many Americans?
I think it's a big issue.
Yeah.
And it kind of crept up on America, mm-hmm. as a society. And what happened, as we know, is after the recession in 08, 09, states, and California was no exception, which had been putting a lot of money into public universities, cut back a lot. In our case, mm-hmm. 35%, upwards of 40%. And so universities cut costs, but in order to maintain enrollment, in order to maintain graduation rates, they needed to, keep paying the faculty, the staff, everything else that goes in the university. And that meant tuition went up by a lot in just a few years. And that, unfortunately, became the new normal. Mm-hmm. So the question is, if that's not going to be the new normal, then how are we going to pay for public higher education? Or if it is going to be the new normal, how do we make sure that students have the financial aid resources so they don't graduate with mountains of debt?
Yeah. In a place like the UC system, you were talking earlier in this conversation, which I was delighted to hear, that the diversity issue seems to be getting back on track all these years after Prop 209 here in California. And as you know, there are other states who passed similar measures. Michigan, mm-hmm. and other states come to mind, who Ward Connolly went to those states and kind of took the same measure around the country. But it's a beautiful thing and a good thing, I think, to have a diverse student body. But when those diverse students walk in the classrooms, do they see professors who look like them?
Right. That's another issue. Yeah. And I think that's important as well. It's something that we have on our minds. How do we make sure that the teaching faculty are diverse? And part of that's a pipeline issue. Mm-hmm. And so part of that is encouraging our students who are studying in things like the STEM disciplines to think about that PhD, mm-hmm. so they can go into the classroom. Part of it's a recruitment issue and being able to compete for those who are already out there, and a retention issue to keep those that we already have. So it's all of those things. None of that will happen without us focusing on it and being very intentional about doing all that we can with respect to diversity in our faculty. And we're making progress. It's very slow. Yeah. And many of us would like to see that, speed it up. But it's not an on-off light switch. It's going to take some time.
Yeah. Finally here, California for so long led the nation when it came to higher education. And the numbers at one point took a dive, and it wasn't a whole lot to brag about. I asked this as a softball to the president of the UC system, whether or not California is getting back on track now, leading the nation where higher education is concerned.
Well, the University of California, yeah. We just saw, it's the fall, so all these various rankings come out, and all of them you can debate, et cetera, particularly the U.S. News and World Report one, which is so flawed.
Yeah.
However, even given that, the UC system it wipes every other public university off the map. Yeah. When in public universities, we're six of the top 10, eight of the top 20 in other rankings. We're the number one, the number two in the country for public universities, Berkeley, UCLA. And you see that repeated over and over and over again. Whatever measure you use, Californians can take real pride on what's going on in our universities. But we want Californians to join us in the fight to keep these great universities great. We can't do it alone.
No chest beating here in California.
There you go. Well, you asked the question. I'll take that pitch.
Yeah. And she put it over the fence. Madam President, good to see you.
Good to
see you.
Thanks
for coming on. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Norah Jones is a 9-time Grammy winner. Her latest CD, called Daybreaks, was released in October. She's touring the country now to promote the project. Before our conversation begins, though, hear now an excerpt of the first single from her album. It's called Carry On.
And after all's been said and done, who said it best? Were you the one? Let's just forget, leave it behind, and carry on. If you should find the time to speak, then speak to me. I'd never keep you from your final destiny. So carry on.
It sounds and feels like a kindred spirit to come away with me to that first big project. Did you want me to feel that way when I heard it?
I mean, that wasn't my intention, but yeah. I think when I recorded it and was writing the songs, it was a lot of piano going on, and I definitely, you know, wanted it to sound a little more stripped down than my last record, because that was with Danger Mouse,
sure,
so it was totally different sonically.
Are you? This is 6 projects in for you now. Are you finding with each project that it gets more difficult or easier to come up with a new treatment?
To not, like, repeat myself?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think for me, I don't really go into the studio until I'm excited by something. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of let that lead whatever direction the project is taking. So I don't find it difficult. I mean, there's so much out there to be done, you know, musically.
To your point, there's a lot of piano on here, and I love it because you're so great on piano.
Thanks.
What did you have in mind when you, to your point, felt ready to go back into the studio for this project?
Well, it started out with the show I did at the Kennedy Center for the Blue Note Records 75th anniversary, and I got to play Wayne Shorter, which was amazing, and Brian Blade, and John Patitucci, and I just kind of thought, oh, this was fun. I kind of want to play with them again. I wonder how I can make that happen, you know? And then I started thinking about recording, and then I started writing songs, which took me in a little bit of a different direction than what I had originally thought. And then it's just kind of about all the songs are done and seeing how they want to be played, you know?
Yeah. What's everybody's process is different, but what's your artistic process for deciding when specifically you're going in? I hear your point earlier that you don't go in until you feel like you're ready to go in, but in terms of the songs, I mean, are you writing 25 songs and you say, I'm ready to go in? Are you writing? What's your process? Because there are 12 songs on this.
There were no extra songs, I will say that.
That's my next question. You remind me. Okay.
There usually are a few,
exactly.
This time there were no extras and we had to find some covers to put in. But I don't know. I think for me, it's just about feeling like, oh, I want to try this. And it doesn't have to feel like I'm making a record. For me, every time I go in the studio, it's like, oh, let's see what this sounds like. Mm-hmm. And if it turns into something, great. And if it doesn't, fine.
Yeah.
You know?
When you said find some covers, I love asking this question of artists who do covers periodically. What is it that Norah Jones specifically is listening for? What is it that you need to hear on a particular track to know that you can give it the Norah Jones treatment?
Well, I guess it just depends on what you're looking for. Yeah. You know, in this case, I was looking for a few songs to round out the record. Mm-hmm. And you really just have to feel like you can own the song and deliver it like you wrote it. Mm-hmm. That's really all you need, which is kind of a big thing, but it also is a very simple thing.
Pick a track in one of the covers and tell me why you chose it.
I chose Fleurette Africaine, the Duke Ellington song, because I was listening to it a lot before Wayne Shorter came in to record.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to write a song that had that thing that song has. And I ended up not. And so I did that song instead. And it's an incredible song, but it doesn't have lyrics, so I just kind of hum the melody.
Yeah.
I said to you when you sat down that sometimes you get a project, or I get a project, and I'll put it in, and I'll listen to it, and I'll get to one track. Like, you got 12 tracks here, so in this case, you get to track 3, and the song is so powerful that for me at least, you sort of get stuck there, and it takes me a couple of weeks to hear the whole thing.
That's great.
Because I keep playing that same track over and over. Tell me about this third track, Flip Side.
Flip Side, yeah, that was a really fun one to play. When it came to the lyrics, you know, it came in a lot of different segments. You know, sometimes you don't finish a song all in one go, sometimes you do. And I think that one I was listening a lot to compare to what? That old Les McCann, Eddie Harris version. And it's still topical today. And it's also, it makes you want to dance, kind of. And I don't know, I was just kind of really inspired by that song. And also just watching it a lot of news and, you know, being depressed over it. But
I hear you and I feel you. So that what's happening in the world around you gets in your head, but you're also a mother now.
Yeah.
You have two babies now. Mm-hmm. How is that, to the extent it has, impacted you artistically?
I mean, I think just personally it impacts you, and that however that seeps into what you're doing, is it's hard to really specify.
Yeah.
It does change the way I hear love songs, which is something kind of interesting. Well, there's different kinds of love now. Yeah. Once you have kids, you kind of realize that. And, you know, a song like the song God Only Knows by by Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys song. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've always loved that song, and I've always thought of it in terms of just regular love between two people. But when I had my son, I definitely started singing it to him and thinking about, oh, my God, this is totally about a kid. But I don't know what it's about. That's just my own manifestation.
Yeah. Back to this point again, that there's a lot of piano on this, which is, again, I love it. I don't know that I can answer this question, but I'm sure that Norah Jones can, which is whether or not six projects in, do you hear yourself, do you feel yourself getting better?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I mean, not overnight, of course, but I think, you know, I was really playing a lot of piano on this record, and it was so fun. And I think I'm playing piano in a much different way. I'm digging in a little more, and I think part of the reason I didn't write a lot of songs on piano early on, I kind of switched to the guitar, is because I felt like anything I tried to write on piano sounded too piano-y.
Yeah.
And now I don't feel that way. And I think it's just because I'm playing it differently. You know, I'm like banging a little harder. Yeah. I don't know. It's just kind of it always evolves. And it's just, you know, it's been a while. So. Yeah.
So I was thinking the other day, when you started, you know, it's now 15 years ago when when the nation got to know of you 15 years ago. When you were signed, you really were, and I say this as a compliment, you were...
Oh, good. No. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, let me try that again. 15 years ago, when you were signed, you really were like an outlier. And you've gone from being an outlier to like the ultimate insider. And I was thinking about that and wondering, what have you learned on this journey from, again, being signed as an outlier? Your style was different. Mm-hmm. Your sound was different. Your approach was different. So you were an outlier. Now you're like the ultimate insider. Everybody loves Norah Jones. What have you learned on that sort of, that's a big question. What have you learned on that sort of 15-year journey?
Oh, gosh. Well, that's a good question. Yeah. I guess I've learned that... you just got to do what you love.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what kind of music you play, and that'll come through in the music, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of other weird stuff.
Yeah. What have you learned about the business of making
music? The business has changed a lot since I had my first record.
Yeah, exactly.
And, I think it's a lot harder for young artists now to make money doing it, but it's a lot easier to get their name out there, but only if they're really good at self-promotion. You know, it's all really kind of a mixed bag, and... I try to just focus on the music and, you know, surround myself with good managers. I have a great record label, you know. I'm lucky in that way.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's changed a lot.
Yeah. How cool was it this summer playing both of those Newport gigs.
That was really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun, and I treated them very differently. Mm-hmm. I had two different bands, both great bands, but, you know, the Jazz Fest band was definitely guys who play a lot of jazz, and the Folk Fest band, you know, they're amazing country rock musicians. So it was really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Six projects in, clearly you're still making music. You still enjoying the process of doing it live?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I try to treat music as my hobby still, and I only try to do it when I'm excited to do it. Yeah. I try not to pack too much into a tour to where we all get too tired. I mean, we got to work, but I'm lucky because I don't have to hit it too hard. You know, I can take a lot of breaks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you say treat music like a hobby, I think I get that, but just so I'm clear, what do you mean by that?
I mean, I don't go in every day like a job and play the piano. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't, like, when I'm writing or when I'm recording, I'm not thinking about what the label will think or record sales. I try to just keep it fun and you know, the part of the job that is a job, you know, I keep that. I have a good business mind, surprisingly, for an artist.
I'm
a little type A, but but creatively, I'm kind of, you know, I like to keep it loose and fun and not think of it like a business, musically, you know.
Yeah. When you said that you don't go into the studio, I hear you and I respect you for not going in thinking that you have to do something that's commercially viable.
Yeah.
But it must feel good, though, that to go in to do what you feel like doing, and when you come out, it is commercially viable.
I mean, who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
We don't know yet.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I make a bold prediction.
I don't know.
Or not so bold prediction.
Or not. I mean, who can predict? I mean, most people don't buy CDs anymore, so I don't know what that means anymore.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, does it mean how many streams you have? Does it mean, I don't know. That's why I try to focus on the music part and kind of, you know.
I think what it means is that when Norah Jones puts out a new project, we're going to get it and we're going to listen to it and we're going to love it. The new project from Norah Jones is called Day Breaks. A lot of good stuff on here that I know you will enjoy. Available everywhere. You can get it. Norah, good to have you back. It's been too long, but come see us again.
Thank you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.